Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. This podcast is proof positive that life is queer. In 1978, glued to Countdown, I never would have dreamed I would have been introducing a podcast of Dave Warner from the suburbs speaking of his novel Sound Mind, Dead Body at the City of Perth Library with Will Yeoman. Proof, anything can happen in life. Buckle up. This is a wild and insightful ride.
Yes, they're rather prone to hyperbole in this place. Anyway, thanks for coming along tonight. Now, I think this could go any which way, Dave, tonight. It's going to be both anarchic and civilised. And the reason I say that is because two key facts you need to know about Dave, apart from everything you probably already know, is that he apparently formed the first punk band in Australia called Puss. And that's one first, and the second first, the first, I don't know, cosy crime event, event down at the caves, Margaret River Way, on which the book we're talking about tonight, Sound Mind, Dead Body, is based. So please welcome Dave.
Thanks, Will. Thank you all.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, a very diverse portfolio, as they say, from you. Tell me a little bit about how these different parts relate.
Well, I guess I always enjoyed reading. And so from the time that I was about 11 or 12 years old, I thought, gee, I'd really like to, you know, write books. And in those days, I read Biggles. It was my favourite. Captain W.E. Johns. But I also loved anything that had dragons and, well, not so much dragons, but knights and serfs and bow and arrow and all that kind of adventure. I really enjoyed those books too. And I remember filling out a form at school at one point. I think it was at the end of what in those days was grade 7. You know, what do you want to do with your life? And I put, like to write books. And I think my father was pretty horrified. He'd been a butcher and, all his life and thought, he's going to wind up doing the same trade as me, which he hated. I enjoyed at school trying to write things, but I very quickly realised by the time that I was probably 13 or 14, I loved music too. And I realised that while there was no chance that I was going to write a novel or even a play for a number of years, I could get my mates and go into the garage and bang out a few songs in the garage band. And so that was a much more realistic goal and something that gave me just as much pleasure. Mm. And so I that's how my life developed initially. I went to uni, and as you say, during university I had an idea of, I knew the sort of band that I wanted to create. The band was Puss, and it was in those days I really liked what you would call the kind of anti-music bands. So my heroes were people like Frank Zappa, The Fugs, I don't know if people know the Fugs, but sort of, you know, anarchic, they really were anarchic, New York poets and musos. But I also loved the psychedelic bands of The Doors, Country Joe and the Fish, and so I had that, things that I liked and wanted to do, and I pursued that for a time, and it was quite successful. I went to England and tried to break into that scene, and didn't really break into the scene, but I made, you know, I did have some great experiences and learned a lot, and I wrote an enormous amount of songs when I was there and developed the Puss idea, which was just kind of that anti thing, but also to be flamboyant and have fun on stage and take it back to almost to an Elvis Presley time. So I had that, but while I was there, I also developed much further in this idea that I wanted to try and do a comprehensive music that took account of everything that I was encountered in my life and all the musical styles. So I love the anarchic stuff, I love the Frank Zappa stuff, but I would also like folk music or torch songs. And in the end, I came up with the idea of suburban rock, and I wrote lots of songs. But the primary thing about them was that they, to me, the powerful songs were going to come from songs that had veracity. And so for me, the veracity had to come from the fact that somehow or other they had to relate to me as a suburban person, you know, a suburban kid who'd grown up in Perth in, I hate to say it, what seemed like an incredibly boring, mundane place where all you did on the weekends was drive around looking for parties that you couldn't find. You know, our Yorkie and Gary Meadows were our celebrities, and Laminex tables and footy were common, and you know, with the sort of common ground that everybody did. So I came back and developed that, and then eventually that kind of ran its course. In a sense, I found myself in Sydney, didn't have a recording contract, didn't have a publishing contract, and I was still playing a bit of music and doing stuff, but I thought, oh, I'm sort of going around in circles here, and I've always wanted to write, now is the time to do it. And that's when I turned my head to writing a novel for the first time, and I chose the crime genre very largely, and this is getting around to the circle of where you started, very largely because a few years before, in 1984, my great friend Dave Zampatti and I had come up with the idea, we were both Agatha Christie enthusiasts, and we'd come up with the idea of doing a play, an Agatha Christie style play, where things happened in and around you, so someone could drop dead at the dinner table or on the golf course, or someone could have a shouting match, and the audience were witnesses to that, and this would, we thought, would give it kind of this three-dimensional, fourth-dimensional feeling. And we did set that in Cave's house in July 1984, and I wrote the play, being a huge Agatha Christie fan at the time, and I felt from the basis of that that it worked well, that it gave me enough confidence that I understood plotting crime genre, that I could do a crime book. And so when it came to Sydney and my very first crime novel, I thought, It should be a crime novel.
Well, interestingly enough, though, it was a very different kind of crime novel, wasn't it? It was The City of Lights, or was that in 1995?
Yeah.
Set in 1975, I think.
It was from 79 to 89, 79 to that 89. Decade.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, it took you this long, then, to get back to that original story, to write this novel.
Yes.
Yeah. How does that work?
Well, I think that from the very first one, as you say, Will, I was there thinking, I think I should try and write a crime novel. I had tried to write a literary novel and found that really difficult. I mean, there were parts of it that I enjoyed, but I didn't think it had hung together that well. This was years when I was still on the road, and for anybody who's played in bands and stuff, it's just impossible pretty much to have a lot of concentration and do stuff like that at the same time. So I thought, okay, maybe it should be a crime novel. I didn't immediately think of doing Agatha Christie. I thought I should do something perhaps that echoes what had been successful in my music. And what had been successful in my music was suburban boy, Perth, sex, footy, Laminex tables. And and so I kind of swapped that into the crime genre. And I didn't really have any plan. It was very organic. I had one big idea for the story, and I started on that and just started at page one. So it took me quite a few years to or a couple of years to write it. And every time I wrote something, it would sound like the book that I'd just read, you know, because I didn't have any plan myself. But I did feel that one thing I felt in my heart was that, you know, Perth, I thought in 79 to 89 is probably not dissimilar to Los Angeles in, say, 35 to 45. Mm-hmm. It's hot. You need a car to get around. It's an early city. And so I thought that the voice for that book that would best suit it was a Kyman Raymond Chandler style first person narrative, and my hero or detective ended up being Snowy Lane, who starts out as a young guy. He wasn't my original hero when I got my first plan of it, but I did realise soon after starting, I thought, no, I need to have somebody who's sort of quite sympathetic or empathetic, people are going to travel with them. And so he became my first detective. And so from then on, what has happened is that I tend to just say, I get most of my books come from a what if, a big idea, I want to do something. Oh, that would be great. I'd love to read that. And so I want to write it, and I get passionate and excited about that. And my second book, set in 1965 in King's Cross, because I thought I've done Perth in this, I would love to do something in the era of King's Cross with crooked jockeys and you know, radios, SP bookmaking, and lots of other dark stuff that, you know, that happened through the 60s and 70s. And so I guess I exhausted myself after all these different genres, and then finally got around to this one, which was partly I just thought, you know, I've always wanted to do an Agatha Christie one, and I've got this book sitting there, or I've got this story sitting there, which could be a really good book. I will have to come up with a detective, because my original detective, we just used Hercule Poirot. There was, you know, no copyright involved in Cave's House. Sorry, Agatha. And the late Johnny Leopard was a magnificent Hercule Poirot, I have to say. But so I had to come up with that. And then I really felt that, you know, I just wanted to do it. I wasn't sure, and am still not sure, whether my fans who are used to the more hard-edged or slightly more comic style of writing, whether they would go for it. But so far, it seems to have been really good.
It's interesting that you kind of dipped your toe in the cosy water with Over My Dead Body, with the Sherlock Holmes character, which is it's a real sort of mash-up genre.
Well, it is. And shall I regale us? I'll tell you a little bit about Over My Dead Body. So that's interesting for me because my first exposure ever to crime fiction was my grandparents giving me a copy of a Sherlock Holmes compendium when I was about 11 or 12. And I read all those stories and loved them very much. And what I didn't realise until later is that these things sit in your head for a long time. And some years later, I wrote a play, a bit like this other one, turned into another book series of mine, the Lizard Zerk series. And the idea with that was a prematurely retired rock musician who is a big fan of Agatha Christie and wants to be an amateur sleuth. And I ended up doing three books in that series. And I was, I always really saw that book series as potentially being a TV series like Heart to Heart or Moonlighting, if people remember those 80s series, which were probably all derivative from The Thin Man going back, the male-female or comic team in parts. And I was writing a pitch for that, saying, oh, just imagine Sherlock Holmes in the present day with a female Watson. And I went, oh, wow, that's a great idea. That's something that I would read. And so my mind started. This was about the year 2002, and in the end I wrote a screenplay, My Dear Watson, and it involved the idea almost like a Rip Van Winkle Sherlock Holmes, where Sherlock is brought back from 1880 or whenever it was that he, I'm trying to think now when it was, something like that, and he's brought alive by Georgette Watson in 2020 Manhattan, and between them they're going to solve a very complex murder case. So what I'm going to do here, I'll read a little bit for you just to give you an idea of the style of this book, because each book demands its own style. You know, that I don't just have one style for every book. This book demanded a particular style. It needed some humour, but it also had to pay homage to Holmes. And my idea, as fanciful as it seems, and once you put this out of your mind and get into the idea of, yeah, that could possibly happen, is that Sherlock Holmes, the story's originally written by Conan Doyle. They were written as penny dreadfuls, I think they called them, or whatever. He was incredibly surprised by how successful they were. He had an episode where Sherlock Holmes is wrestling with his archenemy Moriarty on the Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland. They plunge off the ledge, they're both killed, and that was going to be the end of Sherlock Holmes. But there was such an outcry that he had to bring Sherlock Holmes back. And so in my brain I went, well, hang on, what if it was Sherlock Holmes and Watson, who are the real people, and they fed these stories to Conan Doyle, and Conan Doyle was recanting real stories, but we all thought that they weren't real. And as we all know, Sherlock Holmes is a master of Zen and complete control of body and mind. So when he's plummeting from the edge into the Reichenbach Falls, whereas most of us would just go splat and die, he puts himself into this incredible trance so that when he hits the water, he's like a feather of a stone. And of course, what happens in the freezing waters of the Reichenbach Falls is that he's instantly frozen. So he's cryogenically frozen by the natural waters. Watson, his great mate, pulls him out of the waters, or keeps him in the water, but saves him from drowning. But he can't revive him, so he's in stasis. And for years, Watson tries to revive him, and it's a great, terrible thing for him that he can't. But fortunately, in the year 2020, Georgette Watson, who herself is working on cryogenics and has got guinea pigs to revive, is looking. She's frustrated because she can't find a human body to work on, and then she finds these journals from her great-great-grandfather. She has no idea that he's John Watson, because like the rest of us, she just thinks that's a fiction, and she has no idea that the body is that of Sherlock Holmes. But she goes to Switzerland, retrieves the body, and now here's the scene where they're in the lab. Holmes has awoken after all this time. Of course, he has no idea where he is. And she comes in, and Holmes has a scalpel because she could be a threat. The scalpel could slice the skin from her bone, kill her with a flick of a wrist. She wanted to reassure him. You're in Manhattan. The laboratory's mine. He leaned back, the scalpel dropping to his side but remaining in his hand. Yours? The word smeared with disbelief. Yes, well, part of the Manhattan complex of Rasmussen Biotech. There's over 30 labs in here, and this one is mine. You've been through a lot. You should not exert yourself. I could not fare more well-rested than if I'd slept 100 years, thank you. Your accent adds credence to your assertion that we are in New York. However, that could simply be a clever ruse, the brainchild of you-know-who. Who are you talking about? The professor. The professor has nothing to do with this. This is all my work. He was taller than her by a good... He, of course, means Moriarty. He was taller than her by a good 5 inches, and he looked down a longish nose at her as if examining a specimen under a microscope. What are you? Mormon? A Mason? To what arcane purpose have you kidnapped me? I did not kidnap you. I revived you. Revived? His eyes were piercing, demanding. Perhaps he'd been a lawyer. Yes, you were in, she was about to say inert, and caught herself. Switzerland. Switzerland. She could see him trying to think that through. He shook his head. Unfortunately, my recent history is a fog, perhaps induced by some opiate. I wonder, might you be deceiving me, miss? Doctor. Dr. Watson. He chuckled. Waved the scalpel at her, one might wag a finger. Oh, indeed, you're playing with me. My senses are not so distended that they cannot tell the difference between my dear colleague and an impostor, albeit an attractive one of the opposite sex. So that's a bit of flavour there.
I feel like your concept of veracity is a bit sort of more stretched than ours. That's really
well,
good.
The bizarre thing is once you... Yeah, those things are all external in a way, and once you get into it, It's the human relationships and the way people react to what's around them. Mm. And is that believable?
Of course.
And so, look, there were some very, very funny moments I had in that. I wanted the idea of, I was trying to, you know, how could I get Holmes to be doing some of the things he would have been doing back in 1880? So he grabbed, at one point when he's in pursuit to try and, you know, get the baddie, he leaps onto the the coachman from Central Park and goes galloping, you know, on one of those things. So that's, you know, all fun.
So let's move forward and backwards to Sound Mind, Dead Body. Think about Fred Willett. It's a very different kind of character, but there's a certainly Sherlock traits there somewhere, as well as Poirot and all his classic Agatha Christie tropes that they use, which many, I think the pleasure for many readers reading this kind of book will derive from recognising those tropes and how you play with them.
Well, I hope so.
That's for me.
I hope so. But shall we set the tone, Will?
Indeed.
Now, you're a skilled musician.
No.
And between us,
the truth.
Between us, we've had 1.5 minutes of rehearsal prior to you coming in. So we're going to, and I'll answer while you're doing that, I'll answer that question. And look, I hope so. I really wanted to. I thought it would be great to have this very English drama play out, but I thought it would be terrific to have an Australian detective at the heart of it. And so I thought, you know, what would be a credible way that you could have an Australian in England in 1929 at where this reading of the will is happening among this wealthy family in Devon? And the answer was to create Fred Willetts, who'd been in the AIF as a pilot, and he had fought in the First World War. He'd flown in Mesopotamia and had then gone and fought on the Western Front. And I'll tell you a little bit more. We might give a bit of music, and then I'll tell them the rest. We'll keep them hanging on there to hear a bit more about Fred.
You're going to give me a little bit of a beat, so I'm still
So this song is called 1930s Depression, and it's the only one I had that was remotely of the era. Along the sand, the champagne man prepares his store. Today he hopes for trade. He saw a ship way off at sea between a wave, and then it seemed to fade. And even Colonel Griffiths is tiring of the battle on the stock exchange. The beach resort's deserted, the champagne man still hoping for a throng. While in the street the call goes out, Farlap's arrived, he's bound to be odds on. And please don't worry, mothers, our government has pledged to bring your children food. But the cup, it must go on. Along the strand there's no brass band, on Footscray Hill there isn't any room to stand. And starboard eye, we couldn't care, we came to watch our champions so there. Somewhere in the crowd a knife is drawn, a scream goes out and violence fills the air. And the cup's just been won. Job, no pay, or caused by worthless paper in a nation far away. The champagne man prepares to leave, he packs his bottles so meticulously. Ah, he sighs, things cannot get worse than this, but he was wrong. Well done, Will. Well done. That song, do you hold up the album there, Nick? Because very important, we have the Dave Warner merch table at the same time. That song was actually recorded in 1976 with Tony, who's just gone back to Sydney. We've sent him back, and it's on. That looks like the original Mugs Game album, and it is, except that it's got an entire other album with it as well, with all the demos that I did with Tony in 1976. And that song was just, I wanted to try and capture the atmosphere of 1930. Yeah. So it kind of worked. It was the only thing I could think of that I've written in 450 songs. It's the only one that kind of was 1930s. But yeah, to get back to Fred. So Fred, the idea with that was, Fred's a pilot at great risk to himself in the First World War, which is where the book starts. He sees an injured English pilot in no man's land. He flies, retrieves the pilot, straps into the wing of his plane, flies back. Unfortunately, the the pilot doesn't survive, but his brother, who's a wealthy industrialist, is forever grateful. And he promises that he's building a plane, actually, for his brother so that when the war ends, the brother can fly around the world, which is a great... which would be the passion for Fred Willetts. And what happens is the industrialist... the plane is just finished. The industrialist has died. He's died a couple of years before, but there's been a pause for his will to be ratified because some of the beneficiaries were too young at that time. And so Fred has gone over to England, basically to get his plane. And he goes over there, and lo and behold, murder happens. And he's on the spot. And he's been a detective in the Gold Squad in Kalgoorlie in Western Australia, which, you know, for historians here would know was a pretty dangerous bloody occupation with a couple of coppers killed there and probably a few others disappeared. And so he's got the right background for this. He's not going to be overawed by a couple of wealthy poms, you know, stalking around the wall.
Some sort of antipodean sort of lout or something and treat him as. What interested me is reading some of the notes you had in the back is this idea that you're sort of essentially translating the caves to Devon. And you have this very detailed map in the book too. Is that actually Margaret River and not?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes.
My wonderful editor, Georgia Richter at Fremantle Press, great editor. So what I essentially did was, because I'd written the story to work with the geography of Cave's House, I pretty much just transposed Cave's House to Devon and made the beach behind it, you know, was the beach in Devon. There were a couple of things I had to change, though, because Georgia was going, how did they get from... So there were a couple of little things I had to change in the layout of the place, but essentially that's Cave's straight across to there, and the plot is fairly much the same, but there were, you know, there were obvious developments that I had to do, and how did I get Willetts into it? And it gave me, in the play, you didn't have a chance to go into each and every character, but what I do love about Agatha Christie and about the modern revival of the whodunit is that in the good ones, every single character has to have a complete reason why you suspect them and why they probably are guilty of something. You know, we don't know exactly what. They might not be the murderer. But and so that was a great pleasure teasing that out.
I get the feeling too, reading your books, is that you do think cinematically, and I know you write screenplays as well. Is that something that always interests you? Because you think about a lot of the great detective series, so many of them, like Agatha Christie's, are made into television series.
Absolutely. I wish mine were. I really wish.
There's time.
We've got the new studio here, and I've always thought... but one of the things that I do think of a lot of my novels, particularly City of Light and Big Bad Blood and Summer of Blood, they're very big, dense books, because when I read, I love to have a complex plot. I love a James Ellroy-style book that goes on and then twists and gives you more. And so I think they would make great television series. I genuinely feel that, because a lot of Australian crime TV series that I see, where I get disappointed is the first two episodes are great, and then you have six episodes with nothing really happening because it's just not developed enough by the screenwriters. However, when they're based on a book, you know, you've gone through that. This one you could do as a film, because it is very much like a one setting. And so I would love to do that. I might get you to do the song in a minute, because one of the other cinematic ones, one of my favourite ones, is a book called River of Salt there. And River of Salt came about, it's kind of this interesting fusion of music and screen, and then what happened to be a book. And so I was watching the TV show Mad Men. I don't know how many of you watched that, which I loved, because it really took me back. Everything from the set decorations in Mad Men took me back to that early 1960s period with the Tetchikoffs on the wall or whatever, and the goldfish. And so I've been watching this. It was a Thursday night, and my great friend Martin Cillier, and guitarist, who's a brilliant surf guitarist, was playing down the road in Manly, where I live, with a band, The Atlantics, who had been a really huge band in the 60s and had a very big worldwide hit with a song called Bombora, surf guitar. So I went down to see Martin, and you walk down steps to get there. And as I walked down the steps, I heard this twanging surf guitar. And I'm sure many of you have had this experience, probably all of you. It instantly took me back to a particular time in my life, which was 1961, 62, when I was 9 or 10 years old. And the surf, the East Fremantle Yacht Club down the road, and the sounds that you would hear, and the bodgies and widgies running around, and at a time when sunken lounges were just coming in, and my friend's parents would be getting tropical goldfish bowls, and men for the first time were playing golf as a way to try and expand their corporate or their business interests, you know.
Yeah.
So it took me back to that, and I thought, oh, as I was watching the band, I just had this energy. I was thinking, wouldn't this be great? A great story you could do. You could either do it as a comic thing, a bit like a Happy Days in Australia, set down by the beach somewhere, or you could do it as, you know, a little bit darker, more involved crime. And then my brain kicked in and said, oh, look, Australian TV is so conservative, they won't get that, they won't do that. And you're much better off thinking about doing it as a crime. And so I decided, yep, I'm going to do it as a crime book. I'm going to set it in 1961, 63. And so that book, River of Salt, starts in Philadelphia in 1961, because there were moments in they're almost the first big news stories that I remember. Gretel, the yacht being thrashed by Weatherly, the American yacht. Yuri Gagarin going to the moon. So that, it was a real time for me, you know. So it opens there, and Blake Saunders, who's our main guy and is a crim, unfortunately, he's a hitman for a young guy who's a hitman for the Philly squad, for the Philly mob, doesn't want to do it, but he is, and he's sort of frustrated with this life, and then he hears a twanging surf guitar, and his whole life changes because he just wants to get out and play guitar instead of being a criminal, and he aims to get to California and get away from the mob, but he winds up in northern New South Wales and on the border with Queensland, in one of those places in 1963. And it's like a Garden of Eden for him. He's surfing every day. He's got a little surf band that plays at the bar that he owns. And he's secretly in love with his manager, Doreen, and she fancies him. But because of his terrible dark past, he believes nothing can ever come of this. But there is a scene I was writing, and it's page 33 in the book. And I was writing this scene where he's up on stage with his band, and he's written this song, which is really about how he feels about her, wondering if she's picking up on any of this. And she's down below from the stage teaching the girls the Watusi, because there's going to be a Watusi dance competition that night, and the winning girl will get a transistor radio. So you've got this kind of dual thing happening. But to get it working in my head, I had to write the whole song to get the feel of the scene right. So I got it, you know, I wrote the song in my head, and I thought, oh, that's a pretty good song. I got to the end of the book, and I said, oh, you idiot, I should have done that song. So I got Martin in, and I wrote the song. We're going to give it a go. It's a little tricky. Nicole's going to sing with... Come over here, Nick.
Stay here near the equipment?
No, you can be Doreen. You can come over and adore me, you know, from a distance. And yeah.
I'll go behind
it's,
you.
Yeah.
It's interesting because when I first heard it, I just assumed it was like an authentic song from a different period.
Yeah, well, great.
Very clever.
Well,
yeah.
great. Because that was... I really wanted that feel of the early 60s sort of crooning thing. So let's see if I can help you out here, Will. Do 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 do. About there, sort of. I've probably got the wrong key, but you know. She holds my world in her fingertips, revives my heart with the sweetest lips. It's bliss each time we kiss, but we know no good can come of this. She lifts my soul with those eyes divine, heavenly body, lips as sweet as wine. It's bliss
each time we kiss. Yet we know no good can come of this. Though her love is a waterfall, this man's heart is but sand. She still thinks she can have it all, but she'll rue the day love came to stay. She holds my wound in her fingertips, revives my heart with the sweetest lips. It's bliss each time we kiss, yet we know no good can come of this. Though her love is a waterfall, this man's heart is but sand. Though she thinks she can have it all, but she rue the day love came to stay. My heart beats fast to those angels' wings. Heaven lies here in forbidden things. I've tried to be strong and it don't seem wrong, but I know not alone no good can come.
For Will, he's only had a minute and a half to do that with us.
Thanks, Will. Yeah. This is definitely crime on the fly as we speak. You know, this is hit and run, smash and grab.
What we haven't told you, if none of you is going to escape, because we're expecting a huge sing along last number later on. So no doubt you'll have studied the lyrics. What really fascinates me is your incredible. What's the word? You know, how prolific you are, not just with the writing books, but also the songwriting. And I'm wondering where that facility comes on. Whether it's something that you just developed over time, or whether you were you said you're interested in being a writer straight away as a child. That doesn't necessarily translate to being good at it. Of course, you know, you can have aspirations, but clearly you are good at it. Is that something that you did? You just got better and faster at, like one does with most things.
Yeah, I think so. Mm. Like the initial learning of songwriting was hard, and the initial learning of writing the novel, as I said, the first one was for 2 or 3 years. Mm. That's kind of the nuts and bolts. Where I'm fortunate, I think, is that I just always, almost every day, I would have some idea, whether it's a song or a, or more often a, it could be a TV show or a film or something. That just hits me, and you know, I go, oh yeah, that could be great. And then every now and again, it's like, yeah, that's a really good idea. And the initial creative impulse for me is really strong, really immediate, and charges me, whether it's a song or whether it's stuff. But then from that moment, it's the harder part is or the harder part to learn is then to get down and to channel that and actually learn the process of doing it. And it took me, you know, a few years as a songwriter. I'm hoping I've got the Suburbs 50th gig in October, and I'm hoping to have a book out by then which will have basically every song I've written, which is about 450 songs. And a lot of those are from when I was 17, or actually some of them are even earlier, 16 or 17. And yeah, there's obvious weaknesses in them, and you look at them, and some of them you cringe a bit. But there's other parts of it where I think, oh, that's still really good, or that's clever, or, you know, I don't know how I came up with that. And similarly, some of the stuff that you do later, you go, well, that's really, yeah, okay, that's quite slick or it's clever, but it doesn't kind of have the same, you know, that little bit of inspiration or whatever that you had there.
Well, are you happy to keep those kinds of songs as they are? Because they are records of the kind of person you were at the time that it was. Why are you so tempted to revise some things that it becomes, you know, quite difficult to think, oh, I should leave it alone, or no, I want to, I can do a lot better than this?
Yeah, look, interestingly, I don't tend to change most of those because I feel it is a record. Mm. I did experiment though on my album When. Nick, show the album When, which was really for me was a fascinating idea, and it was the last kind of full Dave Warner album that I did in 2017. I had some great musicians on that: Jim Magini from Midnight Oil, Greg McCange from Skyhooks, all my usual band, Tony, and you know, lots of great players were on that. But the idea of that, and the reason I called it When, was because I was writing new songs at the time. I had I'm on Facebook, But Where's My Friend, and another song called Snapchat. But I wanted in a song like Snapchat, that which was quite crude and rude, I wanted to kind of do it in a way that, so even though it was modern, it still reflected very much the original suburb stuff. Then I had some other songs that I'd written, Lonely Sailor back in 1974, a favourite song of mine, and Vignettes, but I'd never recorded them. So I recorded songs that I'd written then, and then I had a Wimbledon song that, which was a reasonably successful and well-known one of mine, but I'd never recorded a few years, about 6 or 7 years after playing it, I'd finally got in my head the way that I wanted it, and I could tell the band how I wanted to play it, so I re-recorded it that way. But the whole idea of that was that it played with time. There was a song in there, Running Through Brixton, which is written as if it's in the present time, but it's actually about 1976 when I was in Brixton. So I kind of loved that idea of playing with taking something that's old and making it new, something that's new and revise, and doing it a bit like I did with that song, as if it was recorded in that period.
Absolutely.
So I did enjoy that, but in this particular thing with the songs, I will leave all of them as they are, unless there's a song that I can finish. There's a song there, one of my great moments, I guess, in life, in my creative life or life as a fan, was in 1972 or 73. Phil Oakes, the songwriter, came out and did a tour of Western Australia. And we should have done that one, actually. I didn't think of it. But I got to meet Phil, my great mate, Al Howard, was a huge Phil Oakes fan, and he got myself and other mates onto meeting, you know, onto listening to Phil Oakes. And then Phil came and he did a lunchtime show at the Octagon, and then he played in the evening in the Winthrop Tower. And after the show, Al was running around trying to find him. And then we heard the voice of my bass player, Michael Feeney, who I just saw yesterday, actually, from Puss, who was as unerudite as you can imagine. I heard this voice coming down from above, so to speak, going, oh, yeah, the crabbing in Mandurah is really good. So Al goes, is that Feeney? So he races up there, and there's Phil Oakes, you know, Dylan's contemporary, with Feeney sitting there telling him about the Blue Manors. And, oh, they just float past, and you grab them in a crabbing net. And we said to Phil, oh, we were just so stoked that we could meet him. And we said, is it okay if we come and see you off at the airport? And he said, sure. So we went out to the airport. Yeah, I'm 17, uni student. Took photos of him, none of which came out because they were inside and I didn't have a flash, except I got one. In those days, you had to walk. I've got one. He's heading to the TAA jet, as TAA, you know, wouldn't even know it was
shot.
Him.
That shot. Wow.
And I got it through the window. And there's something about that shot, the troubadour, like you don't even know who it is. And that in a way, was his life. Beautiful. Because tragically, he killed himself about 2 years after that. Phil's an alcoholic, troubled guy, and he killed himself. But the long part of the story is that around that time, I wrote a song about meeting Phil Oakes. And it was, I did a couple of verses and stuff. And it sat there like that for 20 years. And every now and again, every 5 years or so, I'll go through them and songs. So I'll just enjoy playing them. And I got to this point and I went, oh, I really love this song, but it's not finished. And it just came to me over the course of a couple of days, I wrote a fitting and correct final verse to it, and then recorded it. So now it's complete. And that was one of those things.
Yes.
But it's rare that I do that. Most of the time I just go, well, look, it's not that great. I'm just going to leave it in the raw. And it is what it is, you know.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, yeah. Just in relation to the craft a little bit more, thinking about, I mean, you were saying that a lot of the subject matter, a lot of the things that interest you, you wanted to incorporate in your writing, whether it's songwriting or the, you know, the fiction. How do the two sort of, the two different disciplines, you know, influence each other or feed off each other? Does it make you a better, a more concise, even more poetic perhaps, fiction writer to be a songwriter and vice versa?
I don't know. Look, I don't know, because to me it just, these things happen and I don't know what the interrelationship is all the time. I think it's it gives me a wider spectrum that I can play with. It certainly does that. For example, when I had the idea of the Dan Clement books, which, and there's four in the Dan Clement series, 2006, I was writing a lot of television. As you said, I do like to, you know, do that. And I was writing TV. I didn't have enough time to do a lot of books, but I had this idea then, and I jotted it down, Outback Noir. And I'd been reading Henning Mankell, particularly the Swedish author, and James Lee Burke. These two authors, American author, where the location is a huge, the biggest thing of the book, really, bigger than even the main character, is the location and the feel you get. And I jotted this down, and then when I got a break from screenwriting about 6 years later, I fleshed out the idea that I had, which was about a cop in the Kimberley and a crime that related to 1979 Hamburg, and I put those two things together. But I'd only had about two or three trips to the Kimberley with the band, and I hadn't done the Gibb River Road or anything like that. Mm. But the one thing I had was, in 1980, I'd done one of my albums, another one there, Nick, which is the Correct Planet one, if you find that. Yeah. There was a song that I'd written in that called Waiting for the Cyclone. Look at my mate Pat there, who spent many years up in the Pilbara and places like that. And the idea of that song was, I wanted that feeling, that impending feeling. It's boring, you're waiting, there's nothing you can do, you're just waiting for it to be hit. And I was really pleased with the atmosphere and tone of that. G'day, Neil. That's my man, Neil, over there, who runs me around everywhere. And so I thought, if I can capture that tone from that song in the book,
yeah, okay,
then I reckon the book will work, because I know people love that song when they hear it. And so I don't know, it's kind of exactly how to describe that process, but the process was one where it's just an intuitive feeling that the way I'm writing this book feels like the way I'm writing the song, even though they're different disciplines.
Oh, I think that's an excellent example, actually. Did it help that you studied psychology?
Not a bit. No, I did psychology for 4 years, and I did it because, like, I think it, had there been a creative writing course in those days, I would have done that.
But done that instinct, yeah.
We did, as you and Mr. Bevis probably did, it was all literary appreciation or whatever it was called, you know, like critical stuff. And I didn't find that...
It wasn't creative.
Yeah, I didn't find that as interesting. I found it of interest. And so I thought, look, well, what I really want to do is play in a band, and psychology, I might be able to get a job. You know, when I finished school, I wouldn't get it doing philosophy, which I really liked, or English, so I'll do psychology. But, of course, the other great thing was that, bless them, all my psychology mates, especially those in my honours class, they were the most cracked bunch anyway. And I thought, you know, God help anyone who's going to them for help.
I was hoping you were going to say it gave you this magical insight into human nature that enabled you to write all these terrific characters.
Well, actually, people do ask me about that, yes. Will, and in general, and I think my main answer is that I think writers are fairly natural people at perceiving what's going on in other people, and that is one of the qualities of writing. You know, you're almost a psychologist, and there are many people who've done it better than me. But you know, any great novel, the psychology in that, I'm sure, is more precise and more interesting than what a psychologist could get.
Well, you're absolutely right, because many of you may know that they often say the great novels teach us more about human psychology than any psychologists would. So you think about Dostoevsky and all those guys, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's certainly my feeling, yeah.
Yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me at all. What is there one? I mean, you seem to have such a broad range of creative outlets and interests. Is there anything that you regret not having pursued that you think, damn, I'd love to have been a champion golfer or something? I don't know. You know what I mean? Is there something you look back and think, realistically,
I would love to have, been a great footballer or cricket player, but I was never going to be that.
Yes.
The only thing within my orb that I feel when people say, have you got any, anything like that?
Mm.
The only regret I have is that when I was 15 or 16, and I loved Country Joe and the Fish, and I loved the Doors, and I loved the organ sound, so I learnt the organ.
Mm.
But I really wish at an earlier age I'd learnt guitar, because I can't play guitar.
Mm.
And it's much more, you can take it around with
you. It's almost ubiquitous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So I really wish I'd played guitar, but maybe I would have written songs in a different way then.
That's
or something,
true.
Who knows,
Mm-hmm. Now, it's inevitable that one has to ask a question about the craft of writing, simply because there's always, apart from distinguished writers in the room, and I know there are always writers, wannabe writers, developing, emerging writers, people who are really interested in how someone like you works. And I know you say a lot of it's intuitive, but this is probably the dreaded question. Is there any advice you would give a young writer? Or a starting writer?
Well,
apart from don't do it.
Well, I'd never say that, because it can give you great satisfaction. And it's almost the first thing that I would say is, I think my musician friends and myself, when I started writing songs, it wasn't because I thought I was going to have a career and I was going to be a superstar. I just did it because I wanted to somehow channel that passion that I had, and it came out that way. And so, as I say, I've got songs that other people wouldn't care. I never play it, but I still get pleasure from them now, going and playing songs that are 45, 50 years old, that I wrote when I was 17. The first thing I would say is never be discouraged. Don't, just because you write something and it's not picked up for publication, and these days you can self-publish, but don't treat that as a failure. The success is in actually doing it. And so, however, and there's, I don't think there's a simple rule, it's different for everyone. Some people work really hard at things. Some people do it differently. Some people, don't write for ages and then do it. So there's no simple rule in how you do it. But I would say if you're interested in it, if you really want to write, and you've got a passion for writing, I think that the first thing is, if you ask yourself a bit, what do I think I'd be good at writing? And this is just a practical thing. I would love to write like Dostoevsky or Gunter Grass, and I've tried that. Maybe one day when I'm 88, I might manage it. But I thought I don't know if I'm good at that. But what are the passions? And then read a lot of those authors, really read them. It's the same as I read Agatha Christie, and I read every book and then I reread them. And just read them, because you're taking on board stuff that you don't even realise you're taking on board until it comes. And that's the simplest and easiest way, and it's very pleasurable as well. And then after that, there's a whole, then it's a complete other question of how do you write, what do you write, and all I can say with that is, I think at some point you need to knuckle down and start, because it's easy to continually put off stuff. I'm not quite ready yet. But at some point you need to knuckle down and start. And once you start, that will tell you a little bit about what your next step needs to be, and how, whether you are prepared or not.
Oh, thank you. I think that's good, sound, practical advice, which is what we all want in the end. should we do a last song?
Yeah, last song. Yeah.
To the doer,
of course.
yeah, she's coming. Nicole is coming, yeah. And yay, coming around here, Nick, you've got a special thank you to the doo-wop lady. Yeah, and but everyone's going to have to help us on this.
Yes,
because
this is something you have to join us.
Oh, plenty of room to dance and sing.
Yeah,
get up and swing from the chandeliers.
About that, Tim.
Yeah. Okay. We can't do all the frilly bits, I'm afraid. So we'll try and.
It's acoustic,
hum them.
It's unplugged.
It's unplugged. This is Dave Warner unplugged.
beside me. I wake up every morning, my mother will chide me. I'm just a suburban boy. I'm just a suburban boy. Saturday night, no subway station. Saturday night, just change the TV stations. I'm just a suburban boy. Just a suburban boy. And I know what it's like to be rejected every night. And I'm sure that it must be easier for boys from the city. I go to the football and I cheer for my team. Go to the football just to hear myself scream. Just a suburban boy.
Just a suburban boy.
Saturday night, no subway station. Just change your TV stations on.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.